Welcome to Roadcase, the podcast that explores the live music experience. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Josh Rosenberg, and I'll be taking you on a journey through in-depth interviews with performers and key people in the industry to explore the magic of live music, how it can be totally transformative for both fans and performers, and we'll look at how they take it all out on the road. It's going to be a great ride, so here we go. Okay, welcome back to Roadcase, everybody. Really psyched to be here. I'm your host, Josh Rosenberg. Thanks for joining me for this special episode with Paul Hoffman of Green Sky Bluegrass. If you're here for the first time for this interview with Paul, welcome to the Roadcase community. If you are a regular listener, welcome back and thank you for your support. I'm really happy that everyone is here. And as I like to remind everyone, there are a number of different ways you can get involved in the Roadcase community and support this podcast, one of which is to follow us on social media channels, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We're at Roadcase Pod. You can also email me. Love to get email. You can do that at info@roadcasepod.com. The questions, concerns, even suggestions for guests. I love to get email and I promise I'll get back to you. We also have a website, roadcasepod.com. You can learn a little bit more about the podcast and learn about the host, yours truly. And there's also a list of where you can also listen to this podcast, which you obviously found out since you are listening to this right now. And when you're doing that, if you can rate and review this podcast, that would be awesome. For example, if you're on Apple Podcasts, you just scroll down a little bit where it says rate and review, hit a bunch of stars, leave a review, couple words. That's a great way to support this podcast and really appreciate your support. So this week, I want to welcome Paul Hoffman of Green Sky Bluegrass to Roadcase. I'm a big fan of Green Sky, and I am really psyched that he's here. Really had a fun conversation with Paul. We talk about his background as a musician and as a mandolin player, challenges of being on the road as a new dad. We talk about the origins of Green Sky Bluegrass, who are celebrating their 20th anniversary as a band, which actually the date was October of 2020 for their 20th anniversary, roughly around the Halloween timeframe, which this year they are celebrating at the Ryman Auditorium for two Halloween shows in Nashville. I'm going to try to make it to those, though hopefully labels will be awesome shows, of course. Timing of this interview was on July 23rd. We talk about Green Sky getting back out on the road at that time. If you are listening to this episode before their shows at Red Rocks, which are occurring on the date of the publication of this interview, this weekend, they're playing three nights at Red Rocks, and I know they're just going to crush it. Thanks again for being here for this episode of Roadcase. I loved this conversation with Paul, and I know you will too. So thanks again for being here for this episode, and I want to send a special thank you to Paul Hoffman of Green Sky Bluegrass for taking the time to be with me on this episode of Roadcase. And here we go. Okay, Paul, thanks for being here, man. I just caught you mid-sip and everything. Perfect start to a perfect interview, presumably.
Yeah, man.
How are you doing, dude? Yep.
I'm well.
Yeah, yep.
That's just hanging. Got a weekend off. It's like Friday and I'm at home. That's the first since April. That's crazy.
A first Friday or like a first kind of stretch of being home?
Yeah, we started playing in the first weekend in May. We played every weekend except one until now. We had one weekend off in June also, but I think my parents were visiting or something, so it didn't feel like a weekend off.
Yeah.
Actually, it's more of a weekend off that way because I have a toddler, so I think
my wife and I went out for dinner. I just need to say your Instagram. I mean, I'm sure you see a comment once in a while from Roadcase Pod going, "Oh Jesus, this is the cutest thing I've ever seen in my life." So congrats on the kid. I'm a dad too, but mine are significantly older. My oldest is 24 and my youngest is 16, and I got one sandwiched in the middle at 19. So
wow.
I've been there.
Yeah.
What's that like?
Busy.
Yeah.
She's awesome though. It's and it's been nice to have a year with her. Now I'm kind of going away and coming back and seeing the differences, even a couple days. I left, was just gone for a week, and she's different this week than she was when I left last week. It's pretty funny. She's getting a little attitude, getting a little sassy. Yeah. She knows what she likes. She knows what she wants. These days, I remind myself these are good things.
Right.
But man,
I know, right?
Makes the day to day sometimes when she doesn't want to do things that are necessary, like drink water or use the bathroom, you know,
or walk somewhere. Yeah.
Oh yeah, we let her. We go for hikes and we let her walk rather than push her in the stroller a lot, and we don't get very far. Like, yeah, we just resigned ourselves to that. You know, that's what it is.
Do you have one of those massive, like, cool Colorado kids backpack things that you bring just in case, or do you have one that you've used?
Man, we have everything. I don't know. Like,
oh my God, the gear.
I wish we didn't have to have everything. We have everything. We have a wagon, a stroller, a bike seat, a bike chariot, another bike seat, you name it. We've got it. Some of it's hand-me-downs, and yeah, it's fun, but, yeah.
I remember those days.
That's mostly what I've been doing, is just flying away every week to play a couple shows and then flying home to entertain and be my daughter's father for a couple days, and on off for both things.
Yeah.
Flip flop.
Yeah. Right. So how are you approaching okay, so we're out of COVID. We'll talk about that, because you guys did some great stuff during COVID, and you know, I want to talk about that and sort of how much you guys give your fans. And I will say, and I've already told you this, I'm a big fan, so you know, love Green Sky Bluegrass. Let's just get that out of the way right here. So looking and having, how old is she now? Three-ish?
She's just over two.
Oh, okay.
2 and 4 months, 2 and a third, I guess.
Yeah, there you go. So you're kind of going back out on the road. How are you feeling about being out on the road and kind of, and not being there for those couple of days? Is that something, I mean, obviously you love to play music. You know, the tradition of Green Sky, you guys have been on the road forever. That's how you built everything up, and you love playing on the road, and that's what you guys do. Has it changed your attitude, even kind of like on the margins a little bit, or made you look at it a little bit differently now with a kid at home?
A little bit, you know, and I was doing it, but for a year, she was almost a year old when we stopped touring. So I had been doing it, and I think I started playing shows when she was 5 weeks old. That seemed like a lot of time off. In hindsight, it's not much at all after what I've just had. It's crazy to think we took 5 weeks off for her to be born and then had a year off. It doesn't bother me that much. I miss her, you know, but I do get to come back and forth. And we did a couple longer tours in that first year, like 4 or 5 weeks. And I was flying home mid tour also, like flying home first thing Sunday morning and then flying back out Tuesday night, or even Monday night. I would even go home for 48 hours sometimes, which is a little exhausting, but, and it's as much for my partner as it is for my daughter. it's hard to be a parent at home alone, but it's been good the last couple of weeks. I missed her the most this last weekend, 'cause we played in Michigan where I'm from, and I, was with family and didn't bring her home. She's not ready to do the plane thing yet, and a 3-day drive was a little daunting. So I missed her most in the downtime around the show. When I'm caught up in the show and doing the thing, I'm busy, and it's nice to have her there, but I'm pretty focused on the task at hand. And it has been quite a task, having that much time off. Like, a lot of muscle memory in my brain and in my body that I had taken for granted, I've been learning again and earning. You know, I had never gone, even, you know, there's like the majority of our catalog we played so often. I probably was singing some of our like more popular songs. I'm singing like 3 to 4 times a month, every month, for upwards of 10 years for some of those songs. And then to take an entire year off, you know, and then some of the rarer songs that we don't play that often, I have to kind of relearn anyway when we play them. It's just like, it's been a lot of relearning, and a lot of that relearning isn't just like re-memorizing the lyrics. It's like relearning the confidence of not being on stage, like shit, what's next verse? Like, yeah. Escaping that feeling has been, I'm there now. It's taking me 8 weeks or whatever it's been. But May was tough. Like, we rehearsed every night before the show and we played everything. We had to. Like, so like I know we were answering a question about
in a formal rehearsal.
We were asking a question about missing my family, but point being, it's just like, it's been a lot of work. It's been really fun and really rewarding to be back. But, you know, we make it look on the internet like we're just jumping in pools and stuff like that during the day, but we're playing a lot. So we'll see. When I go on my first long tour again, I'm leaving for like 10 or 12 days, the first week of September, and then 16 days in the fall. And normally they would come to me for some of that, like in the Western tour. Like, my wife used to live in California. She would come to the Fox Oakland, bring our child. We'd get a babysitter or something. I say that like we did it so much. We did it like twice before COVID. So some of that's not back yet because it's a little hard for my family to fly. So
yeah,
I look forward to it when all that's back and stuff, the balance, it works for us.
That's really good. It's like an organic process. You'll figure out what works best for you guys. But it's interesting to hear you kind of hash it out because it is kind of a new thing for you. Having a kid's a huge thing when you're at home and you're working a 9-to-5 and you've got to kind of figure out the rhythm and everything. And this adds that whole other thing to it, like a whole other level of complication, right? It's all good, right?
Totally.
Yeah.
I work for our family, so.
Yeah. There's that too, right?
it's interesting. We were doing a lot of streams too. So my daughter's been like, and like, we'll be out east. We were in Michigan playing, and one of the shows was 6:30 to 10:30 or something. That's like 4:30 to 8:30 my time. She was awake for almost all that. So they watched me on TV and she knows it's me. And, you know, before I had a kid, I always imagined like, the stigma of like, how could you still be on the road when you have a tour? And I'm like, well, I want to make my child proud of me. I want her to be proud to be my daughter. And I think she's young, but I think we're getting there and that's working out. And, you know, everybody does something different and I want her to be proud of what I do. And if we're there, then it's working.
Yeah, I'm sure she is. What was the field report from her reactions when she saw you? Was that one of the first times she saw you on TV?
No, she's watched a lot of the stuff. We try not to do a ton of TV as a, you know, modern.
Yeah. I hear you on that
thing or whatever, but it's hard, especially being home. Right. But the exception is music sometimes for me. Like, I show my friends playing music. We watched streams through COVID of my friends. And the report from Sunday was that she said, I want to play music like Daddy. I want to be in a band with Daddy someday. And those are like really big full sentences for her just over 2 years old. I got that as a text and I even got it verbatim from her when I got home. I want to be in a band with Daddy someday.
That's cute. Yeah. Right. Mission accomplished. Two thumbs up. You're giving me mission accomplished, right?
Yeah. Totally,
man. What'd you tell her?
I'm to be better practiced. I would tell her, I let her, you know, we have a lot of instruments in the house. We have a piano she bangs on. She's been singing and I let her like play my mandolin with my pick against my better judgment since my mandolin is somewhat fragile and valuable.
Right. But okay. How's that gone so far?
no damage thus far, but I'm not trying to ingrain any fear in the music. So if she wants to like hit the piano with one of her toys or something, I sometimes will say gentle, but I let her kind of any kind of engagement with music or rhythm, I sort of try to encourage.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool. Like you'd think she'd suss it out if you handed her some kind of like older mandolin or something. Like she'll go, "That's not yours, Daddy."
Yeah, she's got a ukulele. We were watching some of my stream last night, actually, because I wanted to see a little bit of what it looked like. We did some sit-ins I wanted to check out. And she was sitting on my lap, and she wanted to get down and dance. I want to dance, Daddy.
Oh, that's so cute.
and then she said, I get my guitar, Daddy. And it was me and John Skeen from Railroad Earth playing mandolin together face-to-face. He's got long hair like me. We're both playing mandolin.
Right.
And she said, I don't know who that dude is.
And
John and I joke that he's my dad. Because he looks like me. And some girl asked us one time, is he your dad? And that was in like 2012. So for 9 years, we've been joking that he's my dad. My actual dad knows about the joke. And actually, they took a picture together in Michigan.
That's funny. That's funny.
But I did not share the joke with my daughter. I didn't think she would understand. I was going to be like, that's daddy's dad.
Yeah, right. And then she'll just get that ingrained and it'll like, she'll spiral out into like a whole other way. No. Yeah, you don't
She's already
that.
Got three sets of grandparents. It's confusing. So.
Yeah. That's great. That's great. And you said you had the visit from the parents too. So clearly grandparents, I guess. Do you have like other, is she the first grandkid in the family?
And for my wife, she is.
Yeah.
Not for my family. I have some nephews as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, not that that matters to grandparents. It's like they, you know, they're still going to show up whether it's the first or the fifth one, but it's always kind of like it's just a tinge of more excitement kind of.
She's the first daughter in my family for a long time. There's a lot of boys in my family, even my cousins and my brother's kids and not a lot of girls. So
right.
Grandma likes her little granddaughter.
Yeah, there you go. I know, right? Those are fun days, man. Enjoy it because they grew up to be 19-year-olds and and teenagers. And God, my middle daughter's going to be like not a teenager. She just turned 19, so last year of being a teen. Not that it actually happens on the year marker, but you know.
Yeah.
It's a challenging. It's a road, man. It's a journey. We'll probably get all kinds of songs about like teenagers being like teenagers after a little while, maybe.
Yeah, we'll get a whole. There's a whole new progression to the story now for me. So.
Yeah, there you go. Do other guys in the bands have kids?
Our bass player has a kid too. He just turned 4.
Oh, okay.
So he's a little ahead of me.
Right. So during the pandemic, you guys like celebrated the 20th anniversary of Green Sky. I don't know exactly what the date, I think it was like fall of 2000 or something like that. So,
well, Halloween is our proper, what we call our proper first show. It was just a party. We played in the living room, but, yeah, Halloween 2000.
Yeah, congratulations on that. That's awesome to be around for that long and be able to, I guess, kind of an auspicious sort of environment to celebrate that in. But yeah, first show. I was wondering, did you come from a musical family?
Not really. My grandma played piano in church and played piano around me a little bit, but not really. My parents liked music. My mom was real into the Beatles. That was really big musical influence for me early on. And that led to me like making mixtapes for her from her LPs. Cause I was figured out how to hook the LP up to the stereo to make tapes and record and dub. And like, I had an early knack for all that kind of technology. Like kids do, I guess. I became the tech support for my parents at a young age. Mm-hmm. But I think that in hindsight, I got exposed to a lot of music that way. And then I started playing violin. As soon as they came around at school and asked who wants to play this instrument, I said yes. So I see that they do that younger and younger now. My nephew, who's right. 5, is taking Suzuki violin through his school, and that's so cool. They didn't ask me until, I guess, 5th grade, the last year of elementary, I started playing violin or viola, actually. Mm-hmm. So that led to guitar, and that led to mandolin.
Yeah, and what were your musical influences at that point? Like, did it move to guitar because you were like, I don't see anybody playing the viola of music that I like? Was it sort of like that?
I still liked orchestra. I played both for a little while before I quit orchestra, but I was also really into musical theater. I did a lot of community theater and all the school programs. By the time I was a senior, I was in like 4 choirs. So I was, I guess my point is I was okay with being a nerd. Like an orchestra nerd didn't scare me. I wanted to get like, cause I was a musical theater nerd.
Yeah.
And you know, I certainly got a lot of ridicule for that, from more popular kids, but it didn't bother me ever. I started playing guitar cause a friend of mine did too. I was about 12 then. And that was just cooler and more fun. I could also, sing. I could accompany myself and sing. And That's probably my real calling is to be a singer. I love playing mandolin and improvising and playing rock music and making weird sounds with my mandolin and stuff. But when I could play the guitar and sit down with the fake book and sing those Beatles songs and sing those Bob Dylan songs I was falling in love with and stuff, like that's what really did it for me. I'd sit around for hours and hours and just learn songs. And then that led to me like wanting to tote around my guitar to like high school parties when I was like 14, 15, 16 and be like, I'll play guitar for you. So nice. Always a little bit of a performer in me.
Yeah. That's a, get out. Yeah. Kind of the melding of musical theater and music. That's an interesting combination. I don't hear that very often, you know? To wanting to be kind of the center of attention, and you were happy. You were that guy at the party breaking out a guitar and just, and being, Paul was a hit at parties.
Yep. I was learning all the Dave Matthews songs and some Fish songs that were easy enough to play for me.
Right.
I was never a great guitar player. That's kind of why I bought a mandolin. Actually, I was going to buy this recording console that I had recorded an album when I was in high school. I made a record. I started writing music and recorded my own record on like a four track. And after high school, I was going to upgrade to like a digital console that was more savvy. And I went on Fish tour instead. With all my graduation money, I went to like three nights of Deer Creek and two nights of Polaris and two nights of Alpine Valley and maybe like a Dark Star show in the middle or something. I saw like eight shows in a row or something.
Yeah.
And I didn't have enough money left. So I bought a mandolin instead. And then early on, I figured out that a mandolin was a smaller pond to play in. It was easier to be good because there were less people doing it. And also it's just easier. The guitar has a inconsistency in the intervals of the guitar that make it difficult. The mandolin is just a square because it's just fifths.
One's not too, yeah. The tuning down to the B on the, for the B string, that's just weird, right? Is that what you're talking about? Kind of.
Yep. Totally. What I'm talking about. What does it go from the, anyway? Yeah. Mandolin's all fifth. So it's like up some bass or a violin, but just, it was just easier for me. My brain clicked on it quicker. So I'm still working on all those clicks, but
how long? Yeah. So wait, so how, okay. So a couple of things. One, you fell into mandolin cause it was cheap. Okay, I'm not going to pull that quote or anything like that, but that's okay, I forgot to warn you about my stupid sense of humor. Like, I like to just pull things and just laugh about them.
No, I make that joke a lot. And so, I mean, I wonder sometimes like what my life would have been like if there's so many variables at play there. Like, if I hadn't spent my money on Fish tour, or if I saw David Grisman play in Memorial Day weekend earlier that summer for the first time, and I was just getting into like Shady Grove, and I didn't know what mandolin was really.
Yeah,
I'm playing, and I was like, wow, you know, he doesn't play bluegrass, he's like this gypsy jazz swing thing he does, and I just loved it. I was like, this is really cool. Wow. So I have David Grisman and Fish tour and the affordability of a Fender mandolin to thank for my entire career.
Yeah, right.
I guess in addition to all my parents' friends who gave me that graduation money that I was spending on all these various activities.
Yeah, right. They were pissed at you that you went on Fish, but now I think they're probably fine with it now.
Yeah, it worked out in the long
run. And so I forgot what I was going to, there was the mandolin kind of being that instrument. Oh yeah. So it was, when did it click? Like, hey, this is kind of easier than a guitar. Like, how long does that take a mandolin player, to sort of make that distinction that, hey, this might be a little bit easier for me. I find that really interesting. Not necessarily the easier part, but the differential that made it click with you. Like, when did that kind of happen?
It's an interesting question. Cause I've said it before. I think, you know, this is like after my year of high school and before my freshman year of college. And I bought the mandolin in like August, right before I moved to Kalamazoo.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to early in, like, I guess in like mid September, I'd only owned the thing for like a month. And I went to an open mic night and I saw Bont and Bruza play as Green Sky Bluegrass as a duo.
Mm-hmm.
And I was young and outgoing, and afterwards I went up to them and was said, this is a famous quote that they like to tease me about. Mm-hmm. I like David Grisman and I have a mandolin. So I asked if I could play with them, and I started playing with them a lot, and then we were doing open mics like weekly. So it's like instantaneously I had a purpose for playing the instrument. And then I also had, I got, you know, I was 18, 19 years old. I had 7 to 10 years of musical training, and I was able to like really sit down with myself and teach myself how to play it because my brain was better than my dexterity. I think if I often think that I should start for the same reason, because I could sit there and be like, oh, this is how you make a chord like this. I didn't need to take lessons. I should have, I could have, I would have benefited from them, but I didn't. I could sit in my dorm room by myself and be like, okay, a major scale goes like this and play it. And then a minor scale, I could, my brain knew how to do all the things. So I was able to teach myself, and had reason to be better every week because we were doing these open mics. And then we started kind of playing shows and stuff. And it's just like steamrolled for me until enough time went by that I was like, wow, you know, I could fast forward. I graduate from college. We start touring full time. I eventually quit my job and I'm a mandolin player. Right. I'm like, wow.
You gave yourself a gave yourself a job in the music business.
Yeah, what if? I mean, maybe it would have been something else. I suspect it would have been something else, but maybe it still would have been the mandolin. I don't know. But like
traveling minstrel performing artist and like some kind of like, you know, caravan going from city to city, which is basically what you're doing now. I mean, like, you know, it boils down to, right?
Yeah, I always played the bard in D&D, so I guess
the bard in Dungeons and Dragons.
Is that, the bard is like the minstrel. It's a character you can play. Bards can do magic and have thieving skills.
Nice.
That's right. I was a D&D nerd also.
I wish I was. I wish I had been so that I could talk to you. I mean, I like Lord of the Rings, and I try to engage on Lord of the Rings as much as possible in any interview that I do. But
we don't need to go down a D&D wormhole. I'm not that versed. But yeah, I think find it funny now that I played the bard.
Yeah.
Because that's what I am.
Yeah, for sure. So open mics, what that was like time frame, like late 90s?
2000, like 2002, 2003. And by 2003, we were playing like paid gigs around West Michigan.
Oh, so the very beginning, since we're talking about 20th anniversary, the very beginning of the band was like, was it that what you just described to me? The I like David Grisman and I have a mandolin. That was October 31st, 2000.
No, that would have been like mid September. So by October, and then we played a little bit for a couple weeks. And then one of the guys was having a Halloween party. So we officially played the party. And that's what we call our first gig.
Ah, okay. So, and is there a through line with your Halloween shows? Because I know I attended one in Chicago Theater where you just did 90s covers, which was really fun. 80s covers?
Wait. 80s covers.
80s covers.
80s. Totally bitching 80s, we call it. Yeah, we've done that one a few times. We like playing 80s covers. We've done a couple of different various things for Halloween. Not always a genre cover. Sometimes we've just done real spooky stuff. Weird stuff.
Yeah, you guys like to do the dress up, man. Is that kind of the musical theater thing?
Yeah, and I like it gets for us. It gets to this point where some bands like don't do it anymore. Like they still play Halloween shows, but they don't engage in the idea, and that just seems less fun to us. We like to have fun. So
I know. I was there at the Riverside Theater for New Year's. I know you and Dave for sure like to have fun. I mean, the I will remind you of the Laverne and Shirley.
Yeah. So we laughed so hard trying to, we rent those tuxedos every year and they never fit right either. And it always is a big joke for us. Back for that Riverside show, we still talk about how we laughed so hard. We were like crying.
Oh yeah.
I can't even remember what all the jokes were, but we were really having a good time that day.
That was amazing. I was up in the front for that one. And, I was hysterical. It was hilarious. Yeah, the open mic. So you were doing open mics and then you guys just kind of started to play. And then talk about how DeVol came into the fold. He was a cello player and then kind of got together with you guys. Cause you know, I just love to hear sort of, you guys really have a true brotherhood in this band. And it's just, for me, it's really interesting to hear kind of how you all kind of form together. Cause it's such an amazing unit.
Yeah, it's important for this length of time. That's for certain. DeVol, we were kind of playing with another bass player around town. He recorded on our album and stuff like that, but he didn't, he kind of joined with the caveat that he would fill in the spot for the time being. And we started to want to tour more and play more shows farther away and stuff like that. And he had a job. He was working for Apple at the time. So Duvall approached the band, and he was graduating from college same year I was, like 2004.
Right.
And, he was a cello major, and he was starting to realize that, like, the classical world industry, classical music industry, is kind of a tough world to be in, man. It's real competitive to get those orchestra seats. And after the way that music school kind of like, it really beats the music into you. They learn a lot really fast. In hindsight, I'm glad I didn't major in music. I tried to, I minored in music instead and then played it in bars every night instead. But he was a little burnt out. So he approached us and wanted to manage our band. He thought maybe he'd get into like the industry side and the business side. And we liked him. We were new friends. He was working at Bell's where we played a lot, Scrap Clubhouse. And we were like, aren't you a cello player? He was like, yeah. And we're like, well, get a bass. Isn't it the same thing? Join the band. He was like, what? And yeah, he did. Basically, like a week or two later, we were like, hey, we got a pickup gig at Shorts. Get a bass. And he'd only been playing for like a week. Right. And we went and played a gig. Wow. And, you know, the rest is history, is the short end of that story.
Yeah.
And then years later, the same kind of thing happened with Anders, our dobro player, in like 2007. Played some shows with the Wayward Sons. He was playing with them. By this point, we're touring nationally. We've been to California a couple times, and we made a name for ourselves winning a contest at Telluride. And like, and we were by no means a successful band, but we were doing it. I think I still had a job working in a restaurant at Kalamazoo when I was home, but played with Anders, and the Wayward Sons sort of were disbanding, and he reached out to ask if he could join the band, which of course was like kind of a heavy question for us. You know, the four of us waited out and we're like, yeah, he's really cool. We like him. He fits in. So we brought him on a tour, fall tour 2007, brought on a tour to give it a trial run under the pretense that like we would just play a tour and see how it went. And we loved it. So he joined the band, and it's, I just was relaying this story to someone else recently. And it's just like, that all doesn't feel like, I mean, we've been a band for 20 years and that just blows my mind, but he's been in the band for 14 years almost, you know, like that, even that, it's been the five of us for that long.
Yeah.
Which is also a huge accomplishment. You know, those first 3 or 4 years when it was the three of us and we're counting those in the 20, they were pretty loose. We were playing open mics and getting drunk on Mike's porch. Like, but the entire time Anders has been in the band, it's 14-ish years. We have been like, relentlessly touring, and in those early days with Anders, I think were the years we played like upwards of almost 100 and almost 200 shows, 186 or 192. I forget what the most we ever did was.
Wow.
But yeah, and that translates probably to like 250 days out on tour a year for like 2 or 3 years in a row. We went that hard. Yeah. I know sometimes people go more than that now, and I don't know what the hell they're thinking, because I went that far and it was.
It seems like kind of the max. I mean, 250 kind of leaves every weekend. You know, that's like 100 days, which is like every weekend of the week. I know it doesn't work out like that. Just to give some context, it's like crazy, right? It's like being on the road. It's like a traveling salesman job, being on the road. I mean, literally, if you broke it down, like every week and then coming back for a week, you know, every week of the year.
Yeah, there's 108 weekend days a year, right? 54 weeks. So
52 weekends.
It's 52, so 104. Yeah, so it was like we played every 5 days a week for an entire year. I never thought of it that way.
Yeah.
That's, yeah, wow. In 2008, when he was new in the band, I remember we did an 8-week tour. And we were like, never again.
Yeah, yeah.
It was grueling.
Well, let's talk, like, what was the, what were your thoughts at the time? Like, your thoughts, management, just kind of band, band thinking in general, like we got to do this. We want to play in front of people. Like what was the break it down in terms of like feeling like band obligation or just as a band, we need to play in front of people versus we want to do this.
Yeah, I think. Like, I. Well, now that we've been like reminiscing.
Well, Paul, hold on. Let me add a third bucket to that is like, we can do this because we are a nationally touring band and we can go to San Diego and then we can go to Bangor, Maine and we can have like that. Like, there's an attraction to that too. So there's a third part to it. Go ahead.
Yeah. All of them still, because we can. Looking at it in hindsight more, especially since we stopped, you know, like the wheel just kept spinning. It's like a snowball effect or something that over get stuck in metaphors. But like, I don't feel like, I mean, we were being smart and we had a manager and we went through some booking agents who had plans. And like, it's not like we were just out there throwing darts at the map or something, but we were kind of saying yes to every opportunity just because we wanted to. And like, every time we would come to a city, we would almost always do a little better the next time. So there was always a sense of encouragement. There was never a point where things just got crazy. Maybe in the last couple of years playing some bigger venues and being like, whoa, we can sell out Red Rocks. This is insane. Yeah. But along the way, it was just like a little bit more momentum all the time. And it's like, okay, if we play this venue enough times, then we can play this venue. And we were, you know, we were driving to the West Coast like two or three times per year, and the Northeast and the Southeast. Not a lot of Texas and then Colorado, but like we were constantly traversing the country. And it was just always like putting one foot in front of the other in a way that was like not thoughtless, but kind of just felt natural to us. And then we would get festival offers. So we routed around the festival offers and then we would do well at the festival. And we were a small enough band that you could be hired back from the festival. You get to a point where you're like a festival headliner and you can't play the same festival every year. But yeah, it's just like, I feel like we were just being led along by some perpetual motion for so long. And maybe even didn't realize it. Didn't even realize like what it all meant until a year ago. At some point in the last couple of years, there's been a little bit more thought put into, you know, when we play shows and where we play shows. I'm not meaning to discredit our agent too. He's brilliant. but, you know, the offers got better every time. It made more sense to drive all the way across the country for $1,000 instead of $300 or something like that. Like, I think the first time we played in Portland, we might have had a $300 guarantee. Right. We drove there all the way from Kalamazoo, Michigan. And, you know, it's like, we did better than that, I think, because we like sold the Goodfoot out. And I remember being like, well, people can come to our show through people game, not $300. I don't know. But like, we sure as shit weren't making any money for a lot of years. And that's not why we were doing it. But yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's the love of being on the road. You don't drive from Kalamazoo to Portland to make $300 if you don't love it.
Yeah. We love it.
Cause you could make $300 like waiting tables over a week or something. I don't know. Right. Like, just to throw an example out there, let's talk about just loving being on the road and getting that fan reaction. What was that? And let's talk about fans and fan reaction and that just riding that incredible, the popular wave, right? But I'm interested in Telluride Bluegrass. You won in 2006, even without Anders. What is that? What is that competition?
It's a band contest. It's pretty common in the bluegrass world. We didn't do a ton of them. We're not a very bluegrass band. So
right.
A lot of them we wouldn't do very well, but Telluride is kind of a, anomaly of the bluegrass festival. There's a lot of progressive things going on there. We said like saw David Byrne there and Michael Franti and stuff. You know, they hire some outside of the box kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And it's the home of Sam Bush, the coolest mandolin player ever.
right.
So we won that contest. And that festival we get to play every year, which winning that contest put a lot of wind in our sails because we had a lot of respect for that crowd. And that festival and like what they curate there has always felt like quintessentially us people who appreciate bluegrass, but like all these other various genres, you know, like if you like Bela Fleck, you might still not know what bluegrass is. It's sort of the same with Sam Bush. Of course he plays a lot of bluegrass, but it just felt like it was us. So we won that contest and then we slowly worked ourselves into being hired back by that festival, which then again, put a bunch of wind in our sails. And then slowly worked ourselves into what we joke as being the yacht club, the bands that get to play that festival every year, which is a lot. And as a promoter, that's kind of a daunting task. How do you keep your festival relevant and fresh when 50% of your lineup is the same every year.
Right. What club did you call it? I missed that.
The Yacht Club.
The Yacht Club. Nice. Yeah, it's just Yacht Rock.
It was the Yacht Club. So we got that honor. I don't even remember what year, 2012 or 13. Since then, we played every year. 14, I don't know. We played 11 of them over the years. But so that festival is just so important for like a sense of pride and courage for us. Like, we want to go out there and play music for everyone because Telluride says we're good enough to do it at their festival every year.
Yeah.
So to us, that means we're good enough to play for anybody. Like,
Right.
I don't mean for that to sound like arrogant or weird, but it's like, that's the confidence we needed to be like, okay, we're our real band.
Yeah.
Somehow 18 years later, we still have to tell ourselves that, or 20 years later.
Well, even winning the competition in 2006, that didn't kick in at that point. It still needed to be something where you were like invited back and like,
man, artists are fragile. We are just, we were fragile. I want to be coddled and appreciated. And
all right.
I don't want to sound shallow, but like,
are you trying to tell me that I said I was a fan, but I'm not complimenting you enough as we go along here, Paul? I can't fanboy out on this thing or else I can't do the interview, but let me tell you, man, that's coming. We're going to get there. We're going to get there.
Brother. Okay. I have a lot of self-doubt.
Say that again.
I'm having a lot of self-doubt.
These days? Seriously?
No, I'm joking.
But that's a thing though. I mean, seriously, I mean, you're out there, you're in the front, man. You're singing every song. Do you struggle with that?
Yeah, not like on stage or in general. I mean, I think from time to time, you know, we, as a band, we discuss, you know, if things are escalating the way they always have been, and, you know, how long does this last? And those are questions to ask ourselves. In the end, I think we just like, we come to a conclusion that we still enjoy what we're doing. And that's the most important thing.
Mm.
Also that, you know, we have a really large devoted fan base, who still loves what we're doing. So if there's examples of places we've played where that number didn't grow from time to time, it's like, it's fine. We're not trying to overanalyze our market share or something like that. It's hard not to ask those questions. Like I said, artists are fragile. Anything you like to love something, to be creative and love something enough to put it out there in the world for other people to appreciate or judge, it takes some stones. There's a lot of
absolutely
a lot of vulnerability there and bravery, and like our songs are pretty honest too. Like I'm singing about my own sorrow up there and like my own pain and my own struggles, and it's hard not to feel vulnerable and like in a place of to be judged by others. Mostly I focused on the judgment is favorable, as I've mentioned, praise.
Yeah, there's an applause factor that occurs after a song too, which must feel good.
Yeah, every now and then something doesn't hit right though, and it doesn't feel good.
Yeah. Are you coming off kind of like sort of feeling like that? Because I know we started out saying that, and you were saying that these shows, it's sort of like, you know, got to get the muscles back in place. Has that kind of set off a little bit of like, oh man, this is more difficult than I thought it was. And I'm kind of putting myself out there again now in front of all these people. I know I said I missed this, but is there any kind of that going on?
No, not really. It's been really fun. The social distance vibe of some of the shows is a little bit different, mm-hmm. to like not the same energy and but you know, in the same way that it's a paradox, because it's like we went out and played some social distance shows where I was like, oh well, this doesn't feel the same, but then it also feels more powerful because no one's been able to do it for so long. It's like it's so moving for everyone, including us, to like be a part of this communal practice, you know, like it goes beyond our music at some point. And that was less obvious before when everyone was just coming to the club to see us play and party. Yeah. But it's like now all of a sudden you're seeing people in their pod way back there and they're having like a religious experience because they're like out with people again, seeing music. And it's not even about my music. It's just like, so that's powerful. it's also less powerful because they're not right in front of me singing along and I can't feel it as much. So yeah. It's like it went both ways. And yeah,
there's a
I don't want to not be doing it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we turned a corner and it is a profound turn for sure. I mean, from going from nothing to something. But were those shows in Michigan, the ones that you just did in Grand Rapids, was that socially distanced? Or you're kind of reflecting back on like the beginning shows that you started to do in May were socially distant?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We did
yeah.
some drive-in and then like the Halloween show that was the 20th anniversary was a drive-in.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, it was like seeing a bunch of cars, business cool. No. But it was also like seeing people and playing music for people again. I was like crying on stage and stuff. So it's like,
right.
It's more powerful in some ways and not as powerful in others. I'm just looking forward to it being, I hesitate to even use the word normal. What does that even mean anymore? But our Michigan shows were not socially distanced. They were just outside. And it was really something to see a huge crowd of a couple thousand people covering the rail again. And, you know, we have a really, you started to kind of transition to our fans. So I'll help you.
Yeah,
we have
please
a really,
do.
We have a really close relationship with our fan base. I think something we learned from jam music, I guess, the Grateful Dead, Fish. This is, we have a community oriented thing going on. It's about more than just coming to see our band. It's about coming to hang with these people that are somehow like-minded and care about the same things, you know, whether that's the music or the idea of traveling for joy or, you know, putting your life on hold to lose yourself in the concert or whatever that is.
Mm-hmm.
We're tapped into that thing and we care about our fan base a lot. So it's like, we know a lot of them over the years. People come see us a lot. They come to a lot of shows, just hear the same songs again and again and again. And I see these people and I know them. They're a part of my life. I miss them. So, and like that reaction and that, like, I don't know, like the responsibility we feel for them too. We want them, we want to give them joy. We want to make every show special for those people. There's like a sense of obligation that's like, there's honor in that, like making that same guy happy for his 200th show is like, how do you keep someone entertained that long? Also, sometimes that person we can do no wrong for. It's like, again, the paradox exists, but we don't take it. We don't take it lightly at all. And to have those people back in our life is awesome.
Well, in that respect, trying to make that person happy and also trying to make the person, it's always someone's first show too. In general, I would say there's not a show when it's not someone's first. I heard you talk about set list creation and how sometimes you feel the pressure to really change it up quite a bit because you've got that guy who's been to 200 shows or every show on that run, even for example, like, can you just mail it in? Do we have to mix it up on that last show? Like, you know, I mean, everyone's been influenced by the Dead in that regard, or even Fish in that regard. I'm just trying to mix it up all the time, but sort of where do you land on that spectrum? It seems to kind of dovetail with your attitude that, we're making it special for everyone.
We honor that ideology. Sometimes to a lesser extent, like if we have a new album, we'll play the songs more often kind of thing, but
yeah, works for me.
For the most part, we play our entire catalog. There's some outliers that we don't play very often or hardly at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and just to be honest, just because some songs we just don't like as much. Some of them are really old and we just don't think they're good.
Yeah.
And we can only play so many songs per night. You know, but we can play 4, 5, 6 of them in a row with no repeats if we want to.
Mm.
Right around the 5th or 6th show, I start to feel like the shows suffer a little bit. If we're really going for no repeats.
Interesting.
But yeah, we're about to release our eighth album. So sometimes it will air. In any case, like I mentioned earlier, just remembering all those songs. We're not a pop band that goes out and plays the set. I don't have any problem with that. There's bands I love like that, and I'll still go see them every time.
Yeah.
And hear those 4 or 5 radio hits that I love every time. And be 100% satisfied.
You mentioned you like Nathaniel Rateliff a lot, right? So, and you mentioned that specifically in what I had heard. I think it was like with Pandolfi that you were like, hey, I want to go because I want to hear those fucking songs.
Yeah, I did. I was just about to use him as an example in my mind too, because I was like, he does that. I mean, he mixes it up too. I saw him play at Red Rocks once, and he played a song he never played live. And
yeah.
He did some special stuff for a producer friend that had died. He makes it special in his own way, but like, yeah, there's a lot of honor in what he does too. And I'm, mm-hmm, you know, I'm down to your son of a bitch.
It kind of goes back to that. There's always somebody's first show, right? I'm a big fan of The National. Let's take, for example, just because, I mean, they're completely off, like the jam band thing, but I could tie it back also. There is a through line there. I mean, Aaron Dessner did produce Day of the Dead, right? And they're mm-hmm. They're big Deadheads, but, it's that you go to a show and they'll play, there's like 6 or 8 songs they're gonna play in every show. I mean, it's someone's first show always, right? But I love those songs. And then they pepper it with other ones that are unique along the run, for example. It's a different philosophy. And Green Sky's in the jam band community. You guys will mix up set list. You know, there'll be some repeats, obviously, but how much do you feel that, where did that come from? Like, was that from the Dead? Was that from Fish that you do want to mix it up quite frequently? Do you feel a responsibility to do that as part of the jam band community? Is that something that you feel is expected of you at this point? Or is it just also, it's kind of like a variety thing from your own personal music standpoint, right?
Totally. I think that we feel an expectation for that to some degree. Mm-hmm. We also like to feel like we can flex that. That's our choice. You know, it's like that thing you were mentioning about those guaranteed songs. For us, it's like, if there are those guaranteed songs, and if you want to be guaranteed them, you just need to come see 3 shows in a row.
Precisely, man.
And then you're guaranteed to hear Leap Year and All Four and Kerosene and Windshield or whatever, hits are.
You just
have to see 3 in a row, and then you'll get them all.
Yeah, that's right.
Most usually. But, you know, I like, there's a lot of joy in that for me too, to be able to be a band who can do that. Like a lot of these pop bands or something like that. Like if Nathaniel Rateliff didn't play his hits at his Red Rock show, I feel like he'd get a lot of flack for it. And that, like, that pressure is not cool either.
Right.
The fact that we can off the cuff decide to play a really random weird show, or because it's a Wednesday, we can decide to do a second set entirely of Dead covers and not play any of our own songs.
Mm.
I feel like we have the power, you know, you say it like in some way, I feel like they expect us to do something unique and special, especially if people have been on tour. So we kind of can't do whatever we want. Can't play last night's show. But in some ways we have the freedom to play whatever. Like, I don't want to play this one jam song tonight, so we're going to do this cover instead. And like, we have a lot of freedom. And you know, by playing some of those songs that are like our songs we improvise in, I don't think they would be as fun for us to play if we played them every show. Like, to be able to get a break from some of those creative moments where we improvise on stage.
Mm.
You know, if we only play the one long jam vehicle song once a week instead of 4 times a week, we're likely to be more creative and inspired to play it that one time. It gets less mechanical and methodical, or like boring.
Totally.
So some of those things still happen too. We fall into these grooves of like where over time the improvisation sections develop these themes that start to reoccur. Songs that were once really open establish these parts that we've improvised and liked, so we went back for them again and again and again. And the more we play them, the more they do that. They start to like find a path, which I think is a cool thing.
Right.
But they become less open. And if we mix up the set list more, we're likely to throw something in there really random one night, and it'll just hit because it'll be something we haven't played in 6 months or
interesting.
And it'll just hit, and then we'll have this really musical moment that we didn't expect because we have the freedom to explore and not do.
I love that. So what about taking like, okay, so you talked about like having a jam and then being able to explore that and it become like feel more vibrant and exciting. If you're not putting it in, you know, you'd play it once a week or once every 10 days. What about song placement in sets? Cause like, I haven't memorized your entire catalog. I mean, I listen to just random shows and know every song, but is there, I've sort of felt, and maybe I'm wrong, and you can correct, clearly you're going to correct, you better correct me, but I have not found that, what am I trying to say? Dead, for example, you'll have songs that are just like, yeah, this is a second set, second slot jam song, right? We're ending the first set with Birdsong. We're ending this with this song. I don't believe that you guys do that. Is it just because I have not figured out, I have not unlocked the code yet? Or are you just not putting song, you're not like, okay, we're always ending the first set with this. We're always ending with this. This is a first, this is an opener. This is a closer. This is the jam slot. It's not to say that you've got jam songs for sure, but are you putting them in certain sections? I haven't seen that. And I think that's unique and it's great.
Yeah. Kinda. I think if you looked close enough, we have habits. Mm-hmm. And we recognize them also, and we try and throw ourselves off by doing different things. Mm-hmm. You know, like some of our big songs are just closer. We like to close the show that way.
Yeah.
And like if we recognize that that's the tendency, then we sort of will acknowledge that, well, it's a smart choice. Like, we're just not going to end the song, the show with a ballad, unless it's like after a really big jam and we want to do something special, we'll maybe do something like that, but we're not going to play a really big jam and then just like throw two more.
Yeah. I mean, that's rock show. That's kind of rock show 101, but it seems like you guys kind of do that. So,
yeah. We throw curveballs out there, open with a really big jam or open with a really oddball cover, there's a formula though. I certainly know it, 'cause I write a lot of the sets. And it's not like it's, hey, we need one of these. It's just like, yeah, I know that's, and that makes it hard to play certain. That's why some songs in our catalog get back shelved a lot, because sometimes there'll be like three or four songs that serve the same purpose in our mind. Mm-hmm. And so those songs are on a rotation of four. There's other songs that serve a specific purpose and they're alone in that purpose, or there's two songs that serve that purpose.
Interesting.
So those songs will sort of flip flop that spot.
Right.
Not that that's a designated spot in the set, but like
it's a concept. It's a designated song concept that if you have three of them, you're not going to play, you know, then you've got three of them and you can kind of rotate in and out that particular, it's a concept, right?
Totally. Like we're this bluegrass band that plays funk songs and prog metal songs and bluegrass songs and slow ballads and psychedelic Pink Floyd jams or something like that. Right, so there's we have all these different like colors in our palette. We're not just like a bluegrass band.
I know.
So we're constantly being like, we need one with a backbeat. We need one with a dark metal tone. We need one with a this and this and this. Sometimes then it's like, if we're really being that formulaic, we become like I often think our band is like a mixtape of ourselves in a way. Like we put together this blend of all of our different little facets.
Right.
And sometimes I wonder if that's less serving of a good show. Other times we'll just be in a mood and a set list will happen where like three of the prog metal tunes make one set.
Yeah,
and
it'll
be
that's
like, is
cool.
that bad? It would be like, is that bad? And it'd be like, no, that's just the mood we're in. We're going to go really deep down that hole tonight.
Yeah.
Hopefully someone out there, they're like, I hate it when they play songs like this. And then we play all three of them, you know, but.
Well, you can't make everyone happy, because there's like, for that one person, there's another 30 people that are like, that was fucking amazing.
Right.
So. That's what I love about your band, Paul. You're a fucking rock band that uses acoustic instruments, and that's like, it just gets me, man. And, thank you for doing that. I just want to like, just get that out of the way.
But you're welcome, man.
God damn. You know, how do you, how did you get to that spot? Like, let's just look at it a big picture. I'm so curious about, I mean, you know, this is what you guys do. I talk to people all the time. I'm like, I love Green Sky Bluegrass. They're like, what, is this a bluegrass band? I'm like, no.
Sometimes.
Yeah. And that's why I wanted to also talk about, and then we're going to go back to the bluegrass tradition as well. But, you're balancing a couple of different worlds. And one of my favorite worlds is just fucking rock, and you guys are crushing it, you know?
Yeah, I think just our influences, man. It's like, it just sort of happened. Like when we lost my tripod there. When I first started writing songs for the band, I tried to write really bluegrassy songs and they just weren't authentic. It wasn't my voice. So more and more our own original music became less and less bluegrass. So over time, the band becomes less and less bluegrass because in the beginning, we just would mix those odd songs in with our bluegrass repertoire. We also always played a lot of really off the wall covers, including a ton of friggin' 80s tunes. And classic rock tunes. Some of the classic rock stuff we play, I wouldn't really want to listen to, but I just love playing. Like we played some Journey a couple weeks ago.
What do you mean we wouldn't want to listen? Wait, repeat that. That we wouldn't listen to ordinarily. I'd totally listen to you guys playing it. Right. I'm not going back and listening to, what'd you do? Down on the Borderline? Like, what'd you open up that 80s show with? Borderline? One of the Madonna's. Was that Borderline? Like, I think the last time I listened to that song was like 30 years ago. Like I would never intentionally put that on, but you guys opened that show with that. I'm like, yeah, I'm in.
I like 80s music more. Classic rock, I'd be less likely to catch me listening to something like Journey or Boston or something like that. But playing those songs is so fun.
Yeah.
So we always had that. And I think that more and more, you know, that the challenge would be to like, okay, so we're going to play. We played Foreplay Long Time a couple weeks ago. Journey. Is that Journey or Boston?
Long Time is Boston. It's been such a long time. Okay. Yeah.
That song, Foreplay Long Time. And so we said, like, that's more recent. But we set out to play something like that. And we're like, okay, clearly we don't have a MIDI synth. We don't have a drummer. And we don't have an electric guitar player. And I can't sing that high. So how do we tackle this piece? Like, how does a bluegrass band play this? And in the early days, it would be like, turn it into a bluegrass song. But more and more, we would start to be like, what if we play it right? But we play it on our instruments. Okay, the banjo's the keys. You, the dope bro's this. Yes. And I'll do this thing from the guitar line while I chop. And like, so starting to like becoming arrangers of music that was out of our instrumentation opened our eyes to a lot of possibilities. Like, I can do this. You can do this. It sounds like this. And then that kind of like, affected the way that we arranged our own music, and usually our music starts sounding less and less like bluegrass. Our own original songs, they have very bluegrass
interesting
roles, you know, like we honor some of those like traditional roles, like the mandolin plays the offbeat, the bass is the kick drum or whatever, like some of those very bluegrassy things stay true, but yeah, we just sort of like learned how to arrange. And then that was always a new challenge. Like, could we do this? What if we could do this? And now that's kind of what going to the studio is like for us when we make new records before. Like, we're like, what haven't we done? What new hurdle is there to cross in a drumless acoustic band? Well, can I make my mandolin sound like this and then play a recording of something and be like, okay, yeah, let's try that.
Interesting.
Yeah, we're just trying to expand the horizons, you know, and then sometimes stuff comes out sounding like previous stuff. And then we have to have that artistic moment where you just say, that's what we are and who we are. It's okay if this song sounds like one from 10 years ago. It's what we sound like.
Right.
But other times we're just trying to find new territory all the time. New thin ice to get a little farther out onto.
Always take that tentative first step and hope it doesn't crack.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is that it evolved from your tackling of covers and realizing that you can play rock songs. You just have to arrange it in a certain way.
Yeah. And then like the band got louder in a live setting. Our engineers did a better job of making us sound like a rock band, which enabled us to play bigger rooms and louder songs and just our own musical upbringing too. Like, only one of the guys in the band has listened to bluegrass his whole life. The rest of us all come from rock and roll first.
Who is that? Bruza?
Yep. Bruza used to listen to some bluegrass with his dad and when he was a kid.
Uh-huh.
But none of the rest of us. I didn't even know what bluegrass was until after I bought a mandolin.
Interesting. Okay. You buried the lead on the mandolin story. That's even more interesting. Huh?
I mean, I knew Shady Grove. I knew Grisman Garcia, but is that bluegrass? I'm not sure. It's more old, like folk music.
You probably listen to Old and In the Way too, right? Which is sort of there, but it's not really like you weren't listening to like Del McCrory early on. and going, that's what I want to do. You kind of came at it. Yeah. I mean, this makes a lot of sense to me, obviously, because it's like, this is what you guys are. Clearly there's a different origin story there. And it's what has drawn me to the band and all your legions of fans, that it's kind of, it's a wholly different vibe.
Yeah. We have a lot of fans who don't, often tell us, like, you're the only bluegrass I would listen to, or I don't even like bluegrass. And I, at the risk of sounding ungrateful for the second half of our name, it's because you're listening to a band who are skeptical bluegrass fans. We love bluegrass, don't get me wrong, but like, we're not up there trying to play bluegrass. That's not like, that's not our voice. And I think that that's where the band just, we just became more like ourselves as the years have gone on. Now some of the really weird shit we do is just, it's just us being less afraid to just be ourselves. You know, that goes hand in hand though, with like, we'll play some 20-minute jam and then just like rip a bluegrass tune because we want to. It might be weird on the set list because those things back to back are really juxtaposition.
Right.
But when we want to be a bluegrass, when we want to play a festival and set up a stage in the campground at 1 a.m. and play an hour and a half of single mic bluegrass, we do.
Well, some of your stuff sounds really great when you, you know, if you, I do, I mean, I love bluegrass, but I don't like love bluegrass. I don't go out of my way to listen to it all the time. I listen to you, I put you guys on, right? But then this, I got to tell you, I just want to bring this up because that beautiful piece that you did in the Telluride gondola. First of all, I love Telluride. I've been going there and skiing there for 20 years. And then to hear you guys, I forget what song it was, but holy shit, that was beautiful. And then, you know, you guys are just getting together, just singing with your instruments. And, you know, there is kind of a, what else do you call that? It's just five guys with instruments getting together and just playing. It's just beautiful.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the that's the bluegrass tradition as well, right? I mean, they're really like, you don't have to say this is classical traditional bluegrass and it has to be a certain way. And you've broken down those barriers, I would say.
No, thank you. Yeah.
I mean, I'm not the expert person to say you did that, but that's being done. I know enough about music to say like there's a barrier there that was fucking blown away in a really amazing way because I approach your shows as rock shows.
Yeah. And so do we, and we're not trying to dishonor the tradition of bluegrass in any way. It's like, we have appreciation for it and just being ourselves.
Yeah.
Which is usually loud and foul mouthed and
yeah,
fueled by rock and roll.
Not that foul mouthed. Not in my world for sure. We're all adults. Yeah, well,
I'm keeping it clean for the interview, I think.
No, don't come on. I want to hear the real Paul. Fans and fans interaction. You guys give so much. You give, I know this because I'm a fan. I mean, you give so much to your fans, not only from the stage, but also sort of, you know, during this COVID period, which has been really, had been really difficult on everybody. Now that we're kind of, we're back essentially, really kicking in the fall. Everyone's going out on tour, you know, for real. You give so much. You guys are just so always, I feel like really in tune with you, with what your fans want. And I love that you guys love to do that. And that as a fan, I feel like, I explore fan bases and that's what I love to do and go to different shows and talk to different people, understand what propels various fan bases and why it's meaningful. And you reward your fans with love, with music, and with product, essentially. I mean, it's really rewarding to be a fan of Greenside Bluegrass. I'll just have to tell you that just from we'd be talking about it anyway if I weren't a fan, like, because it's just so evident in everything that you guys have been doing, from the touring to the live to the streams to how you talk to your fans, and what that all means and the structure of your shows and where you go and how many shows you do. But also as a fan, just thank you. And, what sort of, is that kind of a band philosophy? Is that a personal philosophy? Why, how did you guys get to this point? And am I completely off base with that? I just feel there's like a connection.
I don't think so. Thank you for one. And you're welcome,
man. Thank you.
And you're welcome to hear. I think that it's just natural for us. Like we have a lot of conversations about like what we owe to our fans or what we want to provide for them or something. But I think all that stems from us just being like, aligned with our fans. Like I see myself in the crowd with our fans. I watch fans during a show and I'm like, I want to hang out with them. They're having fun. They look like my people. Yeah. And most of the time that's all the people. I would want to hang out with all of them.
Yeah.
So, and I think that we all feel that way. Like we feel like we are with our tribe when we play a show. Mm-hmm. We're up there, they're watching, but like we meet in the middle and we are the same community. And so I think in that way, we're just actually grateful and like sincerely sort of dumbstruck that it's come this far and we are successful and like that this many people love us. And I mean, we love us, so it makes sense to us, but it's like, we're genuinely like really appreciate all these people. I go out there and meet people after the shows a lot. It's a little different now, I suppose. And we're getting there, but like, I want to go out there and hug people and like take photos and, you know, be the ear for them to thank me. That sounds weird to say. But like, it means a lot. People want to thank me. And I want to be able to provide them with that opportunity because I want to thank them too. And the one doesn't exist without the other. Mm. And like I said, we know so many of these people. It's because over the years, I look out there in the crowd and I'm like, I like those people. I can tell.
Yeah.
And I go hang out with them. Yeah. And then now 10 years later, those people are my great friends. And every time I'm in town, I hang out with them. It's just kind of always been that way.
Yeah. Do you get a chance to do that?
Less now than I used to. Our schedule is like busier and my toddler usually means I take a really early flight home. But yeah, we do visit with the friends and, you know, in the early days, we would stay at people's houses we didn't know and stuff like, And if somebody was like, we have beer at our house, you guys want to come over, we probably would. So, right on. So over the course of 15 years of touring or whatever, like we've got a lot of friends in a lot of cities, who I feel a genuine, strong connection to, I'm grateful to have them.
Yeah. Right on. Right on. Yeah. It's so important, that fan connection. And it's felt out there. It's really, it's very special and you guys are a special band. Must've been really hard for you to be away, especially during this 20th anniversary. I bet you guys had some like crazy shit, probably like, planned for 2020, but then you did these leap year sessions where you, you broadcast a live performance from the Pageant in St. Louis. What was it? I think it was Thursday or every Friday for like every week in August and September, or was it August and September or September and October? I can't remember. 2020.
Yeah, September, October. It was eight sessions.
It was absolutely amazing. And it was so fun and great to see, and hear, everything. And yeah, I want to thank you again for that. And, the production was just amazing. And, how'd that feel for you guys at the time doing that? I'm just curious.
At the time it was really powerful that we recorded them early, as I was mentioning to you before we started, we recorded them in July in 1 week. And it, because of production needs, like to do them live and to do them right. I mean, we couldn't have gotten together every Friday for 8 weeks in a row.
Yeah.
We could have just broadcast every show live for 1 week. That would have been a little much.
Yeah.
And at the time there was like we get back into this like whole jam band thing that jam band fans do where it's like, it wasn't live enough to be live for some people. Every people find something to complain about or whatever, but, it was all about production value for us. Our friend runs that company and they direct a really good show.
Is that Hi-Fi?
Which I think people,
or Hi-Fi is a streaming company, but they also helped you from a production standpoint.
They did all the production streaming. The venue had all the like, production for sound and stuff like that we needed. Uh-huh. I think we rented lights too, probably.
So
we just wanted to put on a high quality concert. And I think that the directing of a good show, I think now people understand a little bit more. They watch the stream and someone who doesn't know the music's flip-flopping the camera on the wrong guy or flip-flopping the camera too much or just weird camera angles. All that kind of stuff is like, was important to our friend that runs Hi-Fi. And I think we put out a great concerts. We did record them in advance and then show them for the first time weeks later. But what, you know, what's cool about that is that we got to watch them with the fans. Like, that was a powerful experience to, like, even just be in observing the chat room while people were watching. And like,
yeah, what was that like? So talk to me about seeing the, being in the chat and seeing the chat. And when you see like a comment, I mean, just like Paul looks bad tonight. You know, no, I'm kidding.
They kept mocking my shoes because I was wearing the same loafers. I normally wear like boots on stage, like a fancier shoe. And I was wearing these loafers because it was just like us and Empty Venue. And they were calling them my dad's shoes. but yeah, it's just like, you know, just to be reminded, like I mentioned, going out in the crowd and like hearing the thank yous from people, you know, having someone tell me that they're hard stuff, you know, like their sister passed away from cancer and this song meant so much to them and they thank me for that. Like, that stuff's really gratifying to hear, but it's also hard to hear. I mentioned that, like, I put myself forward in a vulnerable position and I go out there and then our fans put themselves in the same vulnerable experience position for me. And like, that's a bond that is strong. You know, like when our music becomes that for someone, and I know that and they know, I know that, just this whole thing. So the live streams, to be able to watch the comments and to see all of that and to have everyone be in their homes, but somehow feel together again. And then that togetherness sort of got to include me because I wasn't just on stage playing. Granted, I would have been involved, but you know, during that week we recorded like 200-minute sets per night. And then the Wednesday night, instead we went live, surprise. And played like a 100-minute show. And that one definitely had like a palpable energy from being live. It felt different for us.
That actually in the middle? Was that, did you do them sequentially? So one of those was actually live. I forget which one that was.
We call it the Zero Show. So
that's the one you just put
on
Spotify or recently, the most recent one, the Zero Show. That's a phenomenal show, by the way. I was just listening to that. I love it.
Yeah, and it felt like, so to speak, to that was it live, what was it pre-recorded thing, like that one felt different than the other ones. So it made recording 5, 6, 7, 8 more fun because we knew the power a little bit more than we did when we recorded 1, 2, 3, 4 before.
So you actually did 9.
Yeah, so it was just, it was good to be able to put that out there. And then like, you know, Hi-Fi did the, you can rewatch on Hi-Fi. You can't do that on a lot of the platforms. We just streamed the Michigan shows with Hi-Fi. So I rewatched a little bit of it when I got home. I watched that handle incident I was telling you about with my daughter. That's cool. And like, people were rewatching them. I rewatched a couple of them. Just a cool service to be able to provide. I wonder what the future landscape of the music industry looks like. Like, you know, there's a lot of legacy acts and stuff that don't want to tour anymore, and they can reach a lot of fans in one night.
It's a new normal. That's kind of thing is going to be going on with like venues that are going to be, certain venues will have the equipment to do that. And, you know, we can reach a lot of fans that way.
Yeah. And there's, it's not necessarily a private thing, you know, it doesn't have to be you in your basement alone. Like as things started to open up and get a little more safe, or like even by the time of our Halloween show where it was a little more safe and we were streaming, like you can have your friends over and put it on in your backyard and have a party and watch it with your friends. And it's kind of like being at a show in a weird way. That's neat. When I have friends over in my yard, I often will put the TV out there and throw some kind of YouTube show on because it's just cool entertainment. You listen to music while you're barbecuing or whatever, but you can watch the show too and talk about it with your friend. And I like it.
Talk about Paul's shoes, etc.
Yeah, those stupid shoes he's wearing.
Did you like throw those away or what? I don't even remember them.
Now you'll go back and watch.
Yeah, now I'm going to look for your shoes.
They're just like loafers. They're just comfy. But I got my show shoes back out. We're back. I'm wearing real shoes again. It's cool.
Yeah.
Show shoes are back.
Right on. Okay. That's the pull quote. That's really powerful that you're in the, that you were in the chat and being able to see that. I always wonder about that, about like performers of like, you know, or there's always some management, I guess, that's probably looking at it. It's attractive. Was your thinking like, was there ever kind of like, what if they say something? What if, was there any trepidation going in? Let's say.
No, I don't. Luckily our fans are for the most part, very, very kind. yeah. I can take some criticism. I can take some criticism also though. Like I'm not beyond our flaws. Mm. I'm aware of them probably before a lot of people that complain about them. but it wasn't like that in there at all. A lot of people I know and saying hi to them. And, you know, I've also done a lot of like when I've watched shows, it's weird how that became a sense of unity to be able to like, so our shows weren't live. We weren't actually playing them, but we were showing them for the first time ever at the same time. So there is a live aspect there where like everyone across the country is watching it in the same moment. And all of a sudden people are engaged in that same activity at the same time.
Right.
For the love of the same thing, whether that's the music, the feeling, whatever it is, my shoes. that is what was live about it to me, is that it was like happening simultaneously for all of these people. You can reach out to your friend in North Carolina and be like, oh man, that was a sweet Tied Down.
Right.
And just no one ever, but yeah.
Well, you could do that when, like, say, for example, with one of the Leap Year shows, we could still be watching it together with others that are watching it at the same time. But yeah, you're saying there's that extra level of liveness, quote unquote, because the show was actually happening at the time. And yeah, that is kind of a powerful sort of cosmic energy feel, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's not like the chat room was going to influence the set list. Sorry, fans. We can't read the chat room while we're actually live, but we could feel it. And there is a difference, but
yeah,
still powerful the way we did it. I like the way we did it. In hindsight, I would do it again that way.
I hope you continue to do that in some form, you know? With the shows coming up, I'm sure Red Rocks will be like that. And, you know, others, you guys have been mentors of, like now that you're around for 20, 21 years almost going now, you're, you know, a big name in that bluegrass community. There are others that are just coming up. Do you feel kind of, is there a mentorship of those, bands that can support that will, you know, you want to partner with or like play with you or you bring on stage? Like, I know there's like, you guys have been close with Billy Strings because you're both from Michigan. Can you talk to me a little bit about your thoughts on that and what's, and kind of, what the philosophy is there?
Yeah. You know, there's bands that did it for us too. Railroad Earth, we went on tour with Railroad Earth a bunch and, you know, played with Yonder a lot at the various different incarnations of festivals they had and stuff like that. Still do. We're about to go out to the Northwest String Summit and do something. Mm-hmm. So we just sort of did the same thing for music that we like. You know, beyond doing favors, Billy Strings is really good. We probably couldn't have gotten in his way. You know, if we didn't help him, it wouldn't have done us and it wouldn't have done him a disservice. But we had him up on stage a bunch because we like him. There's a band, the Little Smokies, that we love.
Love Little Smokies. Yeah, I got to see them in the Lodge Room in L.A., which is this tiny little place upstairs in a loft space sort of in L.A. in Highland Park. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to see him tomorrow at Rocky Grass. Love that band. Oh, and the list goes on. You know, in some sense, maybe there's this like noble task of like helping your friend's band out or something like that. But we're just trying to put on a good show for our fans too. So if there's music that we think our fans will like that's a service we want to provide to our fans. Be like, hey, check out this other band you would probably really dig. And then if they do, and that band's going to be on tour for a while, they get to see that band and everybody wins.
Right. Right. Yeah, for sure. So things you've got up on the coming up on the schedule, like you guys are just, you're hitting it now. You did the Shag Bark thing that was in, outside of Grand Rapids, right? Salmon Fest in Alaska. I mean, things are just coming fast and furious. That's going to be crazy, right? Have you guys played Alaska?
Yeah, 9 years ago, and we played the Salmon Fest, so we're finally going back. It's
yeah,
cool.
How's the salmon? Must be amazing.
Oh, good. Last time we traded a show for a halibut fishing trip, and I ended up with 30 pounds of halibut in my freezer. Awesome.
Oh, that's amazing. Oh, so you like played a private show, and the guys took you out. It was like some boating.
Yeah,
thing.
We played a bar for free, and in return we got a halibut fishing trip for like 10 or 12 of us that were out there at the time.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, I got a big freezer now, so if we do that again, I'm ready to go.
There you go. Okay, let's put that out there, folks. You know, maybe we publish this before the Salmon Fest, and that we'll make it happen. And you guys are doing Bonnaroo and Red Rocks, and oh my God, the Ryman for two nights at the Ryman at the end of October. I'm trying my hardest to come to those shows.
Yeah, that's gonna be cool. We were supposed to do those for the 20th anniversary. Now we'll do it for the 21st, whatever.
Yeah, hey. Potato, potato, fuck COVID.
Yeah, we got a real fall tour. We got all sorts of stuff's happening again. I'm excited.
Yeah, that's amazing, dude. That's amazing. And of course, like Strings and Souls are, the vacation kind of thing is already completely sold out. And what about new material? New albums?
We've been working on a new record. So we'll have some announcements for that soon too.
Oh, great.
What's going on? Yeah. We went to the studio a lot during quarantine. That was something we could do more safely than be with other people. It was just be with each other.
Right. Right.
So we spent a lot of time doing that, and we recorded a bunch of stuff. So
yeah, that's right coming. On. Awesome. Can't wait, man. Hey, one other question just about personnel and such. I mean, All for Money, produced by Dominic John Davis. How did you guys connect with him? And then, of course, I'm a Jack White fan, saw him several times play bass, and he plays bass in Jack White's band. And then he played with Dave for that brief tour that he did. I think that was 2020 before the shutdown. How'd you guys connect with him? That's such an interesting kind of connect the dots sort of world thing.
He is, we know him from Michigan. He used to play with a band called Steppin' In It that we love, who we just had at our event in Michigan. He was their bass player. So he's been a friend of the band for 18 years. And he's kind of an industry player. He's a session guy in Nashville too. And, so we just sort of brought him in as another ear. He works for the band actually too. When he's not producing records for us, he does some like day-to-day kind of project managing stuff.
Right on.
So yeah, he's just been a trusted ally. Before the band even had a manager or like any of that, he used to coach me on what to do, because he's a brilliant band leader. He did the books and all the booking and stuff for Steppin' In It in their early days before they had any crew and all that kind of stuff. And he taught me a lot of what I know. So it's kind of just come full circle that he's back with us, and it just makes a good fit. He knows the band really well.
Yeah.
From all those years, and he's a great musician. So He's produced our new project also too. So
interesting. That's so cool, man. Okay, so what are the posters in the background before we close?
That's a Widespread Panic. Sperry is the most famous one, I think.
Yeah.
Fall tour. Spring tour 2013. That's my wife's poster actually.
Yeah.
And then that one is a Green Sky Spusta from Red Rocks. What year is that? 2018, maybe? It was when we did a two-night run.
Nice.
This is my streaming corner. Anytime I've streamed anything, this is like the most, I don't know. You know, it's not like all this kind of stuff.
Oh, right. There you go. Yeah, the kid's toy. Oh, I love that toy, actually. That's kind of a variation on the
kids' toys everywhere. I got a kid stroller over here, a big ball, or
right on. Right on. Okay, I'm really curious about the. Do you mind talking about the bird tattoo?
Yeah, the bird. This is my robin from Michigan.
It's beautiful. And then on this arm, I have really, really cool. That is really cool. Wow.
Thank you. This one I have a Columbine for Colorado. Oh, so my homes.
Right.
Places I'm from.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, thanks so much for sharing so much with me, Paul. I really appreciate it. It was an honor for me to talk to you as a fan, and it was just an absolute pleasure to have you on Roadcase as a guest. It was wonderful to be able to catch up with you and learn so much about Roadcase, and I mean, learn so much about Green Sky Bluegrass. And I love what you do. I appreciate you. And thanks so much for doing what you do, Paul.
Thanks so much for having me, man. It's a fun conversation. And thanks to all your listeners who are listening right now.
Right on. Right on. Okay. Thanks, Paul.
See you out there somewhere. Yeah, man.
Absolutely, Matt. I'll see you. Thanks. Okay, that was Paul Hoffman of Green Sky Bluegrass. I was just so happy to have Paul for this episode of Road Case. It was really delight to speak to. Really loved this conversation. Love talking as a dad myself. It was really interesting to talk to Paul about his experiences so far as being a dad in general, but also as a touring musician and what that looks like from his perspective so far with a toddler. And very interesting to see what his perspective is and how well he's handling that so far. I thought that was super intriguing to talk to him about that. Really loved learning about his musical theater background, which totally makes sense to me, to see the way that he has developed as an artist and as a mandolin player. And of course, the story about taking a Phish tour money, or taking graduation money and buying it to go on Phish tour for several shows in the Midwest. And instead, ends up with very little money and buys a mandolin because it's less expensive than a guitar. So, that was quite an interesting story. And, interesting to hear that he's sort of he's basically a self-taught mandolin player, you know? Just his love of, and gratitude for the fans and his appreciation of, his place with the band, but also being able to bring joy to doing what he loves and bringing his special brand of music to his fans. And they tour pretty much nonstop. These guys have been at it for almost 21 years now. You know, he talked about doing 192 shows in their biggest year, which basically means being on the road for 250 days, which is really, really amazing. I mean, they invested tons of effort into touring and expanding their influence from city to city, and that momentum really started to gain over time and still is gaining, and I really appreciate what they do, and it was really a treat to get insight into what Paul's thoughts on touring and how that has developed along with the development of the band. So I want to thank all of you for being here for this episode with Paul Hoffman. And I really want to thank Paul again for being here for this episode of Road Case. Thanks again so much for listening, and I'd like to encourage everyone to get involved with Road Case. You can do so in a number of different ways. You can email me at info@roadcasepod.com with questions, comments, and even suggestions for guests. Or you can follow us on the socials, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We're at Road Case Pod, and we have a YouTube channel called Road Case Podcast. And of course, you can subscribe to this podcast on your favorite listening platform. And if you could please rate and review the podcast while you're there, that would be great. So I want to thank Waltzer for this awesome theme music that we have. And I want to thank all of you for tuning in and listening to Road Case. We have a lot of great episodes coming up, so I'll see you on down the road.